Hey, what up? Welcome in, Doug Gottlieb, and this is the All Podcast. I think you're going to love this. Here's what we're going to do. We have two guests, and they'll go back to back. Okay, one is, they're actually both super close friends of mine. One is Mike Lewis. He's the assistant coach at UCLA, and he joined me. This is today. We're dropping it on a Saturday, Final Four Saturday. He joined me last night, right before he had to go get another COVID test. And we talked a little bit about his journey, whatever, but more about the team. You'll love it. I mean, I think he gave me 30 minutes. He was supposed to give me like 10 or something. It was awesome. And then my brother, Greg, who was up until this year, now he's at Grand Canyon with the women. And but my brother, Greg, was the longest tenured Pac-10, then Pac-12 assistant with, I think, 6 years at Cal and 5 years with Oregon State. And so I got his thoughts on why the Pac-12, I don't know if we got overlooked or whatever, however you want to term the Pac-12. Anyway, look, the Final Four is upon us. Gonzaga is the favorite. I've told people all year long, they're the best team. Best team doesn't always win the thing, but it's happened more often than you think. It really does. I think the Zags are going to win it. And I think they're just a team where they have so many different, what's called implied threats, right? You don't have to, Corey Kispert didn't make a shot in the Elite Eight, but because you know Corey Kispert is going to make it half the times he shoots it, he's an implied threat. You guard him with the man and a half. And it's a hard matchup for UCLA because once you get past the starters, you're going kind of all defense for UCLA. And then now all of a sudden, you know, when you put Kispert running around shooting threes, Jalen Suggs is a hard matchup for Tiger Campbell because he's so big and he plays really downhill. I like Gonzaga in the matchup. I don't know if I like him with the points, you know, 14th. I looked at BetRivers for their points. You know, they have all the kind of game day setups, whatever. I don't know if I like him with the points, but I definitely like Gonzaga to win the game. And I'll be interested to see if UCLA can keep them within arm's distance because they just found a way to win games. Houston's tremendous defensively, tremendous on the boards. Again, don't think they have the offense to keep up with Baylor. And I think Baylor's a little better defensively than Gonzaga is. They're not as good offensively. But I love Baylor's guards and their toughness and their size at the guards. They'll be fine. I think in order to do a true podcast on the jobs, we'll have to wait till Carolina is closed up. Porter Mosier apparently is going to be Oklahoma's head coach. I have to say this. I think Joe Castiglione is an amazing athletic director. I don't know who he's hiring for the women, but I'm sure she's more than competent, or whoever he hires. But Porter Mosier, though it's not, you know, it's not Billy Tubbs in terms of style, in terms of substance, is big time. And to go from, they had Kelvin, and then to Jeff Cable, I think Jeff Cable's an outstanding coach who's just inexperienced at the time. I think kind of got away from him when he recruited, you know, a bunch of high school Americans, but he was great with Blake. And I think he's doing a good job at Pitt. You know, you go there to Lon, I'm like, these guys at Oklahoma, they've kind of had a remarkable run, even going back to John McLeod, of quality head coaches in Norman. I like that hire. I love the Beard hire. I know the Texas Tech not happy about it. I think Chris Beard's as good a coach as there is in college basketball. He loves Texas as a state. He loves the University of Texas, having been there as a student. And I think you'll get just a slightly better player at Texas than you do at Tech. And I can't imagine how good his program's going to be. He's phenomenal. And getting Chris Ogden to come back home after being at UT Arlington as a head coach, and they're close friends. And I don't know. I know Ulrich Maulguy is going to join him. He's a big time recruiter, big time. So they'll get players. They can coach them. Those are two really good hires. Big 12 is a beast with good young coaches. Unlike, you know, the retirement of Roy Williams, like Jim Boeheim's retired, Coach K's retired. It's one of the reasons the ACC may be a little bit easier to compete in than the Big 12 and Big 10, because Bill Self signed a lifetime contract. Chris Beard just signed a contract. Porter Mosier just signed a contract. Mike Boynton just signed a contract. These guys aren't going anywhere. And so their programs are going to be awesome. They just are. I'll see what TJ Altsenberger could do, being back at Iowa State. But we'll have to do a whole pod on the hires and the thumb up, the thumb down, we can call it now. I want to get you, though, to this conversation with Mike Lewis. Mike, of course, was a great player at Indiana. He was Bob Knight's last point guard. He got, I mean, I got fired after that 2000 loss to Pepperdine. We were supposed to play him. We played Pepperdine instead. But Mike's well-traveled, played in USBL. We played against each other. That's chronicled some in a previous podcast we have. He worked with Chris Beard at Texas Tech back when Coach Knight was there. Mike is a tremendous, he was the offensive coordinator when he was at Butler as their head coach. Then he went to Nebraska under Tim Miles. And now he's at UCLA with Mick Cronin. So what's it like in the bubble? What's it like with this team? Let's catch up with Mike Lewis. All right. So this is your hotel room behind you. We'll only do a little bit of video just to tease ahead. But you guys arrived, what, Selection Sunday?
No, we arrived on Monday the 15th.
That's right, because everybody else was there who knew they were going, and you guys had to wait to find out.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, so take me back through. It's Friday and Saturday of Selection Week. How did Selection Sunday?
Yeah, we lost in the Pac-12 tournament, lost a tough game, and so we decided to go back to L.A.
You lost four in a row, but to all teams. You went back and look. You have like one, I think it was Utah, is like the only non-tournament team you lost to, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, we lost to those four in a row. All four teams were in the round of 32 and three of them were in the Sweet 16. So, we weren't finishing games. And, you know, free throw here or there, you win a couple of those. So we ended up going back to L.A. We didn't feel like the setup in Las Vegas was the safest maybe for us. Two or three free days, you're in a casino. So there's people moving all around, and trying to stay away from COVID. So we went back to LA where we've had success, staying healthy all year. And, we got together for Selection Sunday and we were feeling good until the last region. And we hadn't heard our name called yet and we're getting a little worried. And then, luckily we got in the first four, thought we probably deserved to be a little higher than that, but that was the hand we were dealt. And so we've played it and it's worked out pretty well.
Okay. So what does Mick on? Okay. And as honest as you can, when you see Michigan State in the first four and you tell the guys, hey, listen, it's a great opportunity, blah, 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 blah. Like, all we got to do is keep winning. You close the door. You're in his office, coach's office. You're in the,
we haven't been in our offices since last year when COVID started. We've just been in a conference room in our practice facility. We haven't been in the offices. So we actually, when it first came up, really a sense of relief, that we were in the tournament, that we were going to get a chance to play, extremely happy for our guys that they were going to get an opportunity to play in the tournament. Cause nobody in our roster had played in the NCAA tournament. And they're at UCLA. So that doesn't happen often. Right. But then we knew we had our hands full. And once we talked to the guys and we got back together and started to, divvy up the scouting responsibilities and game prep and obviously all the travel stuff, you were waiting to hear from the NCAA when our flight was going to go and making sure we could have time to practice in Los Angeles before heading to Indianapolis because we knew we had to quarantine for a certain amount of time once you arrived in Indianapolis and making sure we were going to have an opportunity to practice before playing Michigan State. So tons of things going on logistically.
So did you practice on Monday before you left?
So we practiced at 7:30 on Monday morning before heading and jumping on a charter flight and arriving in Indianapolis. The time change, flying across the country is really what smooths
the day.
Yeah. On that. So we did, we got a good crisp 90 minutes in and jumped on the plane. We got here to Indy. I think we got to our hotel about 9 o'clock, immediately got a COVID test in. And then we were quarantined in our rooms and they dropped food off at our doors. Slept, woke up. I think we had a test again after, 12 hours, had to go back to our rooms for another six or seven hours until our second test we got the results and got the okay to, practice late at night on, I think that was Tuesday.
So
it was Tuesday and then our practice was that we had to go to West Lafayette I don't know if that was Tuesday or Wednesday. I think it was Tuesday. They're all run together. We've been here 3 weeks, but our practice time was from 9 to 10:30 p.m. In Lafayette. So we had to jump on a bus and make that beautiful ride up to Purdue and practice. So, and we got back, you know, obviously you get back at, you know, it's after midnight, 1 o'clock.
Okay. Side note, there's a bunch of other things here. You're in Indy where you used to live, right? From Butler.
Yes.
IU comes open as well. I know that's kind of near and dear, and you're back in your home state as well, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go through first, the Indiana thing comes open. Okay.
Yeah. So we're at practice. We get done with practice and I get, my phone is just blowing up, you know.
Which practice?
The practice in LA. So prior to getting on the charter flight is when it happened. And my phone is just blowing up, obviously, you know, being a former player, you get a lot of texts from friends, from former teammates, other former players that I've gotten to know over the years. You know, just, you know, your program's without a leader. So everybody's, you know, wondering what next is. So it was, not only are you getting ready for the NCAA tournament and doing all those things and trying to get settled that way, but you also got, you know, a program very dear to your heart that's making a change.
How hard is it going to be? You know, Mike obviously played for Coach Knight. That's kind of the bond, right? Which is a big thing. I can tell you just, you know, I like Mike Boynton a great deal. He's done a really good job and he's trying really hard. It's just different when you're not coach, and he does all the, he does, like, literally checks. If there was like an OSU bingo, like, he knows, he gets bingo all the time. Yeah. Right. But he still, yep, you know, if he just would have played there, it would have been so, so different. Okay. But Mike is a very, very different era from you. Mm-hmm. What's the gen on text? Like, what's it like in regards to the hire?
Excited about it. You know, I'm extremely excited that, one of us, you know, got the opportunity to lead the program. I think that is really important, especially at a place like Indiana. I think, you know, Woody's experience, not only playing in Indiana, playing in the NBA and then coaching in the NBA, you know, the guy understands basketball. You know, he gets it. He understands Indiana. He understands what it can be. He was a part of it when it was rocking and rolling. You know, he understands it and he cares deeply about it. Like I told somebody on the radio today, I was like, you know, that this has to work for Woody. Like it can't fail. Like it has to work and he's going to put everything he has into it. I think Scott Dolson's going to give him the resources to be successful. But if you're Mike Woodson, you have no choice but to be successful, because could you imagine being Woody and failing at this and then having to go have dinner and sit across the table from Quinn Buckner and Scott May? Like, you know, you can't do that. You can't look at your former teammates and everybody else in your program, you know, after, if this doesn't work. So I have complete trust in Woody. I think he's going to do a great job. I think he's going to get Indiana basketball back on solid ground where we can become, you know, Indiana again. And what all of us know Indiana can be, because I think he cares way too much about it. He's going to pour his complete self into it and get it done.
I know they're not IU guys. Okay. And they're both very different personalities, but why, like, just your outsider looking in of a program you love, why didn't it work? I mean, Kelvin, obviously he couldn't get out of his own way. I think some of it was the wrong guys. But the last two, like Tom comes in, he's got like a 10-year deal and he started to get some players, but could never really figure it out. And then Archie went there that long, but never seemed to figure the place out. Like, what is it that is so unique and so difficult, other than, you know, you're kind of chasing ghosts of five banners that are hanging up there in the end zone?
Yeah. You know, I think Indiana is just different. It's just a unique place. I think the fan base is very passionate. Some say they have unrealistic expectations, you know, I mean, maybe to an extent, but, you know, are they unrealistic now? Because they weren't unrealistic 20 years ago.
Right. It's interesting. Here's the, you're at a place
yeah.
that's famous for unrealistic expectations. And, right.
And our guys have embraced it. Like I've said this many times in these last 2 weeks, being back here in Indiana and getting asked it all the time. Like I work in a place that has 11 national championship banners. Like, that's really cool, you know, and there's a ton of responsibility that comes with that. And you have to embrace it. And I think that's why Mike not only understands our program, he was a part of it, right? He knows what it can do for people. He knows what it stands for. He knows what it means. And he embraces all that. And I think it's hard for somebody that doesn't get that to truly embrace it, right? You know, it's just, oh, it's just a job. It's, you know, it's Indiana. Right. But like, it just means more to the people that have been a part of that program. Just like if, you know, Oklahoma State, like you understand what you just talked about with Mike. And I think Warren's done a great job of Oklahoma State. But like, when you've played at a place that has the history and tradition that Indiana has, it's just different. And it's hard to explain. And if you don't understand it, then you just don't get it. And it doesn't mean you're a bad person, but it's just, when you wear a uniform like that and play for the guy that we played for, and you have the feeling of what that means to so many people, not only former players, but fans and everybody else, you know, it's just a special, special place, and we just got to get it back to being what it can be.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
How would you tell some, because I do think that one of the things that's really hurt Coach Knight, had he gone to TV around the time that you played for him, or 5-10 years before that, right? 5-10 years before that, when he was kind of at his peak in terms of personality, success. I know he didn't win a national title after the 80s or whatever, but you know, like early 90s, had he gone, he'd probably still be on TV and he'd be revered. But because he was kind of grumpy old man by the time he got in, he didn't really watch, just didn't go well, and how it ended in Indiana, right? Because of those things, I think that you say the name Bob Knight now, and a lot of people take the negative that overwhelms the positive. There's going to be negative there, right? Just is. Yeah. But there's a lot of positive.
Way more.
Having experienced and having lived it, and now having worked with others and for other really good coaches, like, how would you describe your experience, which was not always pleasant, was not always perfect, of playing for Coach Knight?
Well, I say this a lot. I use it in recruiting. Like, I absolutely loved my college experience at Indiana. I mean, I loved it. I would do it again in a heartbeat. And when I'm talking about my experience, I'm talking about the whole thing, right? Coach Knight played a major role in my experience, and was a huge part of it. And I know how I personally feel about my experience, and I want the players that I coach, if they feel about their experience, wherever I've been and wherever I've coached them, if they feel about their experience the way that I do about mine, then I'm doing something right. So, and Coach Knight played it, like I said, he played a huge part in my experience. He's played a huge part in Woody's experience and all the other players there. And he just means a lot to us, you know, because we're around him every day. We don't just see the, you know, blips on TV where, you know, whatever's going on, you know, we see and know the real Coach Knight.
You know, what's interesting is I want to get to each individual game really quickly and then to the Zags, but you've been through a lot, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you decide to leave Butler, and it was kind of your safe zone. You probably could have stayed there for a long time and then gotten a head job in the Midwest, you know, but you chose to go and try with Tim at Nebraska. You guys had some success, had some failure. Then you get fired. Then you're out of work for a couple months. You're going to hang out with Brad in Boston, right? You're trying to figure some stuff out. Then you go to UCLA. And as people who know, like, it wasn't like you and Mick were super close. Like, you're learning to work for a new guy in a new city, completely different, right? And it's a different job. It's not like you're living right around the corner from campus, very different. And then you guys had some early success. Then everything got shut down. And then you had this weird end to your year after a crazy losing nation, and Chris gets hurt, et cetera, and you have a big transfer. Your wife is your high school sweetheart. Right. I got to wonder, like, when you get to the Final Four and you call her, I don't know if you got to see her or you call her, like, What has she said about this crazy ride?
Well, you know, COVID is different in California than it is, you know, here in the Midwest. So my girls are I just began going back to school in person for like a half a day. Right. And so we just felt like, you know, they've always, I think one of the coolest things about coaching is when your family gets to experience, you know, things like this, because, you know, you're not around them a ton during the season. And so this is kind of like the end goal and the vacation, so to speak. But we decided, because they couldn't travel with us on the team plane, they can't stay here with me in the bubble. So they would have been separate. I couldn't see them anyway if they came to the NCAA tournament. Plus, they would have had to quarantine for 10 days when they returned, which would have taken them away from, you know, school and volleyball, which they're doing and they love and enjoy. So then we decided to keep them back. And so they didn't come to the NCAA tournament, and we win a game, and, you know, it's like, oh, good job. You know, we win another and another, and hey, we're going to Sweet 16. And, you know, and Nicole, my wife's name's Nicole. She's like, and we're coming out. I'm like, no, that's, you know, they need to be kids. Like, this is their first time going back and being around other kids. And
I remember we came over this summer. They hadn't seen anybody.
Nobody.
And so they were like, our kids are like best friends because they hadn't seen anybody.
Exactly. And they had never met, you know, but they just had a blast. So we just, you know, I'm like, nah, whatever. And I said, if we can pull two more off, like, you're coming, you know? And so we got to the Final Four. And so they landed about 45 minutes ago. They're staying in the hotel, I mean, right next door. So I'm hoping to, my room doesn't face that hotel, but I'm going to go to, I'm hoping they're on this side where they're facing.
Get away.
Like, wave through the window, you know, like, how sad is that? But I'm happy they're here. I think it's great. It's going to be a blast. They get to experience it. Like, we were able to go outside. Victory Field is just over my right shoulder. And we walked around outside just to get some fresh air. And they, you know, they escort you over there and all the safe stuff. And Mark Few is standing inside Victory Field, and his family is standing outside Victory Field talking through a gate. But that's how we get to communicate, you know, like it's not ideal. Right. But I do give the NCAA credit. They have done an unbelievable job, in setting this up where we can do it in a safe way. And these guys get the experience of playing in this tournament. I couldn't imagine, everything that went into logistically pulling this off, and they've, you know, we're a few days from getting it done.
Okay. So you mentioned you got to break up the scouting report for Michigan State. How does Mick do it?
Well, Mick's on every game. So we're a typical staff. Like, we just, you know, every third scout is yours. And, you know, Mick just dives in head first on each one, game to game to game, you know. And, you know, he'll meet with that particular assistant that's in charge of that scout. And they bang out the game plan and go work. So,
okay. So who had Michigan
preparation,
State?
His preparation is off the charts.
Who had Michigan State?
Darren had Michigan State.
Okay, so Darren Servino has Michigan State. Game was, and this is my, and look, you coached in that league, so you tell me if I'm wrong. I believe, my belief.
Yeah.
Huh?
It was a football game.
Right, but this is my belief. People are critical of the Big Ten. I'm like, no, Big Ten was that good this year. It was a great league. Okay, but every game I did, that's what it looked like.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like. It was just, it's a football. It's grabbing and holding and guys falling around. And all of a sudden you get into the NCAA tournament and they don't, and some of them, they don't let you play like that. Some of them they do. But I think that hurts them, because, you know, when you can hand check and you hold dudes, you know, sometimes you can get away with things. Like Loyola, I thought the way they played Illinois, for example, you know, as opposed to the way in which Illinois guarded them. You know, Illinois just kind of grabbed them and chased them around the court and played man up and funneled everything back to the big guy. And that's not the play to play Loyola. I think the way in which their league plays and is officiated, I think that sets them back when they get to the NCAA tournament. You've experienced it. Is that wrong? Like, you tell me your thought.
I mean, there might be something to it. I don't know. I always, you know, I think, you know, matchups have a lot to do with it. We struggle. We're down 11 at half against Michigan State.
You're down 14 the first half, right?
14 yeah, at one half. Point. Yeah, and I think it was 11 at halftime. And, you know, you can speak about the physicality to your team. I'm not sure they really believed us. Now, we played Ohio State early in the year, and we told them then, and we got punked. So we told him Michigan State is, you know, Ohio State on steroids as far as the physicality. And, you know, you're down 11 and a half. It took us a little bit to warm up and embrace the physicality of the game. And now once we did, then we were able to take control, you know, in the second half and eventually win it overtime.
But what'd you change? What did Mick change at the half, which kind of freaked
you out? Soft. Like, hey, like, listen, you can't be soft. We were kind of trying to keep them in front. They're a big set team, and we were just trying to guard the sets. And we're like, you know, listen, let's just go try to blow everything up. Let's blow up ball screens. Let's get out in the passing lanes, try to, you know, because they're a point A to point B to point C and very crisp in execution. We just try to take them out of that stuff and just be much more aggressive and more physical.
They call timeout, and they're going to have the ball for one last shot of regulation, okay? Because they end up, I think it was an Aaron Henry, like, contested jump shot, I think is what it ended up being.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
What do you remember what was said in that home?
No, I really don't. I do remember we had a good idea that, hey, listen, they're probably going to go to Henry. And they just, I think they just ran like a little ISO for him in the slot where he could rip and drive to his left hand. Just do not let him beat you going left. Like, if he's going to beat us, make him beat you going right. Do not let him beat us going left. I think Jules Bernard did a great job on that defensive play and had a great contest. And then we got in overtime and really, really got out quick.
Okay. So then you get that done with that one. And then now the fun starts. Now you get an upset. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So we got BYU, who is a great offensive team. You know, they play extremely fast, the pace of their offense. And I thought we did a really good job against BYU, just kind of taking away a lot of their ball screen actions and their dribble handoffs.
How'd you do that? How'd you do it?
We just stayed aggressive, just blew them up. Like, we're going to hard hedge. We're going to switch our likes and just be ultra aggressive. You know, we can't be passive. We learned that, obviously, in the first half against Michigan State. We're going to guard Harms one-on-one, try to push him off the block, try to keep him off his right shoulder, you know, because he struggles to score, you know, other than his right shoulder, and just make things really difficult. And we had a great defensive effort. I mean, I think they got 60 on a last second shot at the end, and they normally average 80. So again, we're where we are in the Final Four, Doug, because we've played, you know, however many, what is that, 9 consecutive high level halves of defense, and that's why we're where we are.
When you had never worked for Mick, you guys knew each other a little bit. There was like mutual respect there, right? Mm-hmm. When was there a moment where you're like, oh, this guy can really fucking coach?
Right? Yeah, it was, you know, I believed it, you know, when I went there. I knew he was good. But in our first year, when we're struggling, I think we started 8-9 or 9-8, something like that. And he wouldn't give in. Like, he wouldn't give in to those guys. He's like, this is how we're going to play. This is how we're going to win. Like, this is what winning basketball is. Like, you know, you guys have to change. Like, you can have a different voice in this locker room, but you guys have to be more coachable. You guys have to change your mentality. You have to change your approach. You have to change your work ethic, you know, and to those guys' credit, they did. But he never compromised. Like, he never gave in just, you know, rev them up and try to win this game. Like, this is how we're going to win. You know, and he looked at it from a long-term, you know, situation. And he's like, we're going to set a standard of how we're going to play now. And we're going to recruit to it and this. But our guys bought in, man. They bought in. We went on that run last year, and we've had it all year now. I think he's one of the best in our business. I really do. He's got a great way of coaching these guys hard, yet they know how much he cares about them. He's got a great balance when it comes to that. I mean, I truly believe he'll be the guy that hangs the 12th banner in Westwood.
I got about
5 more minutes.
Perfect.
Because I got to do like my 180th COVID test of the year.
So. Okay, and I don't want you to miss it. Then you miss it. Okay, so tell me about Johnny, okay? Because Johnny last year, I did a couple of their games, and it was a bit too much, right? They went to a 3-guard lineup, so he had to play some 4. Everything was fast. You know, he's in the SEC. There's grown men. How did you get back to being himself? And by the way, that play for Mick, the weakness in his game has always been kind of toughness and defense. Mm-hmm. So he's got to earn his, he's got to earn the respect of Mick. Like, how did you guys get him right?
Well, I think the one thing that people don't, you know, that is underestimated is he reclassed and moved up a year. Like, right. That's hard. But I mean, you know how hard it is going from senior year of high school to freshman at the high major level and that adjustment. Right. And just imagine trying to do it a year earlier. Like, it's really, really hard. And especially at a place like Kentucky. And so this really should just be his freshman year of college, honestly. But he came to us and he is coachable. He was open to, you know, us coaching him. We were very straightforward with, hey, you know, for you to achieve the things that you want to achieve and become the player you want to be, you need to do X, Y, Z. Like, you can't be a nobody on the defensive end. We was very honest with him. And I think he respected the fact that, hey, listen, these guys understand my deficiencies. They're going to push me to get better. They're going to be there to work with me to get better. And he's bought into it. You know, like, has every day of practice been great for him? No. Like, you're going to go through growth as a player. But I do think he understands that, and I told him, like, when you express to me what kind of player you want to be, then that's the player I'm going to try to make you. And I'm going to push you every day to do that. And you've got to meet me. And he's proven that he can be, his defense isn't where it needs to be yet, but it's a lot better than it was when we got him. And he's much more conscious. He's competing harder on that end. He's embraced more of the physicality of the game. And once Chris got hurt, you know, Mick set him down and talked like, hey, you've got to become more than just a shooter. Like, you're going to have to be more of a leader on this team and more of a scorer, not just a shooter. You're going to have to get to the foul line more. You have to be able to put the ball on the floor more. And he's really done that. He's really grown into his role, and we wouldn't be in the Final Four without him, obviously. I mean, the guy's carried us on a few games just by himself.
I got two more that you can go. Yep. First one is, you mentioned Chris Smith, who tore his ACL. And there's video. We'll put it on this. There's video. From Matt Norlander's TBS, who's getting mixed doing the interview. And first, you're talking to your point guard, right, and Tiger. And then you go over to Chris, who's not celebrating with the rest of the guys, which is like, that's the job. Everybody doesn't – I think everybody thinks the job is drawing up plays on a napkin, right? That's the job, right? You're in the people business. What'd you say to Chris?
This is my first Final Four, Doug. So, like, I didn't really know how to react, you know. And I just turned around and I saw, you know, Chris just sitting on the bench, like, you know, in his own thoughts. He looked a little bit emotional. And, I mean, I can only imagine how he feels. The guy blows out his AC. He enters the draft, comes back to do and accomplish exactly what we are accomplishing, yet he can't be a part of it. You know, and so I just went over you know, he's as big a part of what we're doing as anybody else. He was here when this thing got started last year. He was through the rough times when we first got in here. We're trying to establish how we want to play, how we're going to win. he improved as much as anybody a year ago, his game and what he can do. He put himself in a position to be talked about on draft boards. He decided to come back to make himself more attractive to the NBA. Was just starting to round into form. The 6 months of not seeing our players in person, I think, really affected him and his development. But he was really starting to come into form. And just, you know, letting him know that, you know, he's even though he's not playing, he's played as big a role as anybody else in us getting to the Final Four, and how important he's been to this program. And, you know, his buying into us last year kind of got everybody else to go along with us. It was just it's a cool moment.
How do you beat Gonzaga?
You got to make the game ugly, in my opinion. I mean, I don't know. Like, nobody's done it. There's no blueprint on how to do it. They're really good, very talented, very athletic. They're big. They're good defensively. I think they're underrated defensively, if that's possible. Extremely well coached. I mean, they got everything you want in a college basketball team, Doug. And, you know, the good thing is we're not in the NBA. We don't have to beat them four times. We just got to beat them once. I think for us to be successful, we've got to muddy it up. Just try to frustrate them, control tempo, You know, be physical. We're gonna have to get some breaks, and then just try to get it to the under eight timeout with a chance, and then try to be there at the under four and see if you can't get them to crack. But I think the first thing that we have to do is survive the first 5 to 10 minutes of the game. I mean, they come out and go right at your head, and you better respond. Otherwise the game will be over. So they're an excellent, excellent basketball team, but you're not going to get any freebies in the Final Four now.
Last thing, kid from Indiana, played Indiana.
Yeah.
You coached at Butler, but after the Final Fours.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're at UCLA, but a massive underdog. Have you at least thought of the possibility if you win the next two games, what that might be like for you?
Yeah, I think you always think about it. You know, you always think about it. Like you always think about being in the Final Four. And I didn't really know how to react when it happened, because you just like, you know, I sat down on the bench, Doug, and it was just like, just kind of tried to take it all in, and was just looking up, and you know, just kind of, you know, my career from playing to coaching and everywhere I've been, and all the people I've come across, just you know, kind of, you know, all the different you know, memories and feelings and all that type of stuff. To win this thing, who knows? But this group here they've proven everybody wrong so far. You know, I think you just go out there and try to win the first 4 minutes, and then try to go win the next. You know, I think.
How about your backup? Your backup center was great.
Yeah, I mean,
great. Four charges.
Yeah. I mean, we go into the Final Four with Kenny Nwuba playing 20 minutes. It was unbelievable. Like guys have really just kind of embraced their role and just.
I'm sitting there going like, why aren't they playing Etienne? Then he throws Etienne in there with like 5 and a half to go in the game. I was like, whoa, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing,
I
mean, Vic?
I tell you, when it's hard to explain, but when you're with a team and you've been on some, when you're with a team that it clicks and they get it, you know it. You know, and it's hard to explain how it happens, all that stuff, but we're in a pretty good spot right now. These guys have really competed hard, and it's been a lot of fun. I mean, if we can win two more, you know, when you're at UCLA, like when you're able to make your mark in history at UCLA, like you've done something. And these guys going to the Final Four, they get to put a year on the big boy banner. So, but you're at UCLA. So if you want to sit at the big boy table, you got to get yourself a ring.
All right. Well, go get yourself swabbed. And then we're going to do another one. If you win, we have to do another one.
Absolutely. Okay?
Because it's good luck. Right. Yeah. And then regardless, we're doing a postseason one. And we're doing beard stories. That's what we're doing. We're doing Chris Beard stories.
Wait, if we're going to do beard stories, we probably need to have a beverage or two while we're doing
them. That's what we're going to do. And we can get Beard to do it with it. He'll do it with us. You know, he's got his fireside chats or whatever. He's bringing those to Austin. We'll do some. We'll do. He will definitely keep Austin weird. All right, go. I appreciate it. I wish you the best of luck tomorrow. Go kill it. All right.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks, Doug.
All right, that's it for Mike Lewis. Now let's welcome in my brother, Greg Gottlieb. He's been an assistant coach, San Diego State for 8 years when Steve Fisher took over, Cal for 6, I think Oregon State for 5. So no one knows the Pac-12 like Greg Gottlieb. You were the longest tenured assistant in the Pac-12. What's your reaction to the league's success in the NCAA tournament?
Well, first of all, historical perspective. My first year in the Pac-12 was the last year the UCLA went to the Final Four. And that, by far and away, in the last 15 years, was the best year of the league. Because if you look at the talent that was in the class in the Pac-10, you're talking James Harden was at Arizona State, O.J. Mayo, Taj Gibson at USC. You got Russell Westbrook, Kevin Love, among probably a half dozen pros on that team at UCLA. I mean, everybody, the Lopez twins at Stanford, everybody had pros. And so at any rate, I'm looking in this year and I'm thinking tremendous pushment. A lot of times I think the Pac-12 hasn't gotten the credit when credit was due because they didn't do well in the non-conference. And I think everybody would attest, if you're in the league, say when the league is down, the games weren't any harder to they weren't any easier to win than now. And so I'm looking at it right now. I think you got Oregon State, they win the conference tournament. They were playing hot. They kind of came together at the right time. UCLA just was a gritty team all year. I mean, they had more close games than probably any team in the country. You know, Colorado, I think, was an extremely experienced team with just about everybody returning and added a couple of really big time grad transfers. And they were pretty consistent all year long. We all knew Oregon was the most talented team in the league. And USC did an incredible job of kind of melding a group of some of their core returning players and a bunch of grad transfers and then somebody special like Evan Mobley. I mean, it really, there's only one freshman that really made an impact at any one of those teams, and that's Evan Mobley. So you're looking at an experienced group, and I think in today's game, you win with experience, and that's probably a big reason for their success.
Okay, so the question becomes, how does the league parlay this into more success?
Sure. Well, again, I'm going to go backwards a little bit. I think success has many fathers and failures an orphan. And right now, I saw where a lot of the athletic directors of Pac-12 come out and start patting themselves on the back and saying, boy, we did a great job with this new scheduling philosophy has really helped our programs. And I don't see where scheduling came into play this year, because a lot of teams didn't even play the schedule they had initially scheduled a year in advance. Number one. Number two, the teams they didn't get very high seeds. But I do think you look at a program like Oregon State, and I think now all of a sudden, you know, there's a lot of people that are talking about them. There's a buzz that's created. They've kind of, you know, winning in the tournament kind of gets you a little more credibility. So now they'll be able to get to the table with maybe kids that are a little bit more highly regarded, whether it's high school kids, local kids, you know, even the portal, which right now everybody's recruiting kids in the transfer make. So, but because everybody's doing it now, there's still a pecking order. And, you know, but you're going to see teams in, you know, obviously USC having a tremendous Taj Eady, probably one that has probably had as good a year as anybody as a grad transfer. But you're going to see those grad transfers are going to look and say, hey, why not go there? That worked out pretty good for them.
How do you, and, you know, when you were at Cal, you didn't have any one and duns. They had Sharif and they had Jalen after you. But there's some people that believe, well, it's like a cognitive thought to recruit a one and done, whereas I don't actually think that's the way it works. Like, I could be wrong. I haven't recruited like you have. So, like Deshaun Nix, for example. Okay, so UCLA, when Mick got the job and he hired Mike Lewis, Mike's a good friend of mine, and he said, like, our number one focus is Deshaun Nix. We want a big-time point guard. He's the best one. Now, obviously, it was a bit of a bad luck because of quarantine last year and the shutdown. And then Deshaun, who was all in on going to play in college, decided to go to the G League Select when they kind of upped the offer. But when you start recruiting a kid, is there any level of concern with them being a one and done? Is that like a cognitive, like, hey, we should recruit him? No, he's a one and done. We should not recruit him.
Well, I definitely think that was something I learned working for Mike Montgomery, you know, and you know, he was the one that kind of pointed that out a lot of times, because I don't think it's necessarily bad if a kid's good enough to go to play in the NBA after his first year. But I think if he's already got in his mind he's one and done, and he's already got one foot out the door before you get there, or he's everything's all about me, then I think those kids are going to be hard to win with, to be honest. Because at some point, I don't care who you are, how good you are, you got to give yourself to the team and make some sacrifices. I think you saw that with Evan Mobley. I think, you know, he didn't need the ball every time down the floor. He was someone who could make plays even when he didn't have the ball. There was obviously times that he did make some plays, but other people stepped up as well. So he was surrounded by other experienced players. You know, I think when you look at teams that have struggled with the one and done kids, it's teams who are entirely led by guys that are A, inexperienced, and B, like I said, that one and done, super talented. But I mean, Ben Simmons is the first one that comes to mind. His team didn't go to the NCAA tournament. You know, there's been a bunch of them. Markelle Fultz, you know, they really struggled, and he was the number one pick of the draft when Washington struggled. Sometimes it's hard to win with those guys because of their, sometimes it's a little bit all about me, but I do think the right kind of kid, there's still a place for those guys. But also you got to, you know, now everybody's recruiting 1 year at a time, regardless whether you're talking about a one and done for a lottery pick or you're talking about a kid who's got 1 year left on a grad transfer. I think most teams right now are trying to assemble their roster for next year right now. That's it. They're not thinking about what's happening in 4 years. They're trying to assemble next year's team because kids are going to leave.
Do you like that?
I don't know that I necessarily like it or not. I think, you know, it's really more about analyzing what's going on and then, you know, adjusting and adapting to what's happening, number one. And then number two, you know, trying to be creative and in terms of what your recruiting strategy or philosophy is, because if you're not at the top of the food chain, you're not going to necessarily get the same guys that everyone else is. You're not pissed off the same beer as everyone else, so to speak. So, you know, I think if you look back 10 years ago, you know, Iowa State was an example with Fred Hoiberg. They made a living on transfers, but no one else in the league was really recruiting transfers. They were getting high school kids. But now Kansas is taking a transfer. I mean, I just saw where Kansas is taking a Division II kid who's transferring up, who's supposed to be a heck of a player. But the point is, I mean, if the people at the top of the, you know, the basketball food chain are recruiting transfers, and if you're not at the top, you may need to find another area, you know. And then evaluation becomes a really important part of the equation as well, because there's a lot of evaluating kids on film right now based on synergy, which is how you watch all the college game films or junior college game films, Division II films. Everything's on synergy.
Yeah, I think, though, that one of the things that we've lost sight of is, you know, and, you know, it's interesting that it coincides with the Supreme Court case against the NCAA. But no one's ever, like, there was no question of why do people watch a college basketball team play, right? And you watch because your school and you learn about the kids, but you also watch because the kids, but you've seen them kind of grow and evolve over time. And now it's like, we need name tags for every kid on every school. And then like how many, like now we have like 2-time transfers, which is a lot, you know? And I think we're taking it from a bit of the core of what it's supposed to be about. Because everybody's chasing after that, whether it's the almighty dollar or recognition or playing time, whatever, like people are going to, they continue to struggle to watch, especially early in the year. Cause you're like, I don't know who these kids are, but the ones that I do know, they're playing on a different team than I remember. And that's really, that's just hard. You know, in college basketball is at its peak. And granted, there's always been guys leave early. And this is just, but this is the AAUization really of college basketball, and that, you know, it almost feels like at some point we're going to go to, oh, you're unhappy this semester. Well, next semester you go play at a different school.
I think there's validity what you're saying, but I mean, you look at the NBA, and I mean, the NBA has got, you know, same thing. You got guys that are forcing trades, and there's people that are constantly on different teams, and people are going to still follow their schools no matter who got the school. I guess. As a coach, my thing would be just, you just got to see where the trends are, and instead of fighting it, you got to kind of be able to figure out how you can thrive given whatever the scenario is. Cause we could say the same thing about the rules and the way some of the rules that have changed the way the game's being played, and whether we like it or not, but this is how the game's being officiated, or these are some of the new rules, or the 3-point lines here, it's further out than what it was. So that's the rule. I mean, there's a lot of things that kind of go into the way the game evolves. Yeah, it's really hard to build a program because kids that are freshmen, very, very unlikely they're going to play 4 years in your program. And we still are trying to help these kids graduate. And, you know, we want to turn them into people that can be productive in society when they move on. You know, those are still big parts of what you're doing, and mentoring is a big part of it. And I think, you know, you hate that kids could potentially drop, leave when there's a sign of adversity, when things don't go well. It's not my fault. It's coach's fault, or these other scenarios, and you'd like to see them fight through the adversity, because everyone's going to face it at some point. And that's the thing that I think is interesting, you know. And if we go back to the Pac-12 overall, you know, back to the original question of why we think they're so successful, you know, even the word adversity, I think every single one of those teams faced a good amount of adversity during the course of this year, and really came out on the other end really strong. I mean, with Oregon, I mean, they hardly played during the month of January and early part of February, and still had a chance to win the league, which is incredible, right? Or, you know, Oregon State, you know, they started off slow. I mean, they had a couple of really bad losses early on and didn't think like things were going their way, and they turned it around. You know, UCLA, adversity, lose your best player early in the year. They lost a handful of games down the stretch. Get in the play-in game, and I've been in that game, and, you know, a lot of it is your attitude and mindset, because sometimes, you know, your kids can be disappointed that they're in the play-in game, or they could be excited that they're just glad to be there. And if you're at UCLA, we expect to be there. That's hard. So that's a tremendous accomplishment for their staff to handle that. And that's really been a huge deal with this year, is all the adversity. And again, back to what we were just talking about, you know, you wonder how kids are going to handle adversity all the time. Are they always going to quit? And are we teaching them the right thing, to give up and go somewhere else? So
it's an interesting fine line, right? Because there are some kids who are like, hey, you're not going to be happy unless you're playing, and you're not going to play a ton here. Or by the time you do play, you know, you may be so embroiled in unhappiness. On the other hand, there is the, you know, there's so many of these stories of kids who, you know, you wait your turn, you get your turn, and your game is developed, you take off, you know, and it's the overcoming adversity angle. It's like a really hard thing to balance. And then the other thing that's,
I'll tell you, one of the best things going was, it was on my Twitter feed one day. I believe it was a kid from Abilene Christian who didn't play a minute in the game, and they kept showing him behind the bench and how fired up he was. And, you know, those kids are now, those kids are, you know, they're rare. You know, sometimes you pan over a bench and you get a kid pouting, you know, because they're not playing, you know. So, you know, right now that's one of the biggest things as a coach, is to try and get all your everybody on your team willing to sacrifice a little bit of themselves for the good of the order. And usually they're the ones that benefit the most. I think most of these kids that have just recently, like we're talking about the Pac-12 or teams that go to the NCAA tournament for the first time in school history or things of that nature, I mean, they're so appreciative of the sacrifice they made. Looking back, I got to believe every one of those kids in all those programs we're talking about right now are on a high right now, and realize, like, you know, those are going to be moments that are going to be talked about for years, you know, at their prospective schools when they come back and talk about, you know, Oregon State being at the Elite Eight, you know, or USC at the Elite Eight, UCLA going to a Final Four. You know, those are things that people are going to, they remember those teams. You make history.
What do you think of Gonzaga?
Man, you talk, again, I'll tell you, that incredible team. And I think what's not talked about enough, and we were just talking about adversity, but, you know, and every team faces it, but the adversity for Gonzaga is, you know, how do you handle success night in, night out? Like, he's done such a good job of not just level-headed and be ready to go, but, like, they compete night in, night out. They're so consistent, you know, and some of that is just about your ability to deliver effort. You know, you could get beat by an inferior team on any given night, and, I mean, they are so consistent with, you know, they have an inside-outside punch. They got great shooting. Guy like Kispert, it might be one of the best shooters in the country. They got guys that can score at the block. They're hard to score on. They got good length. They got a great freshman guard. I mean, they got a little bit of everything, and they got depth. And I got to believe their practices are a war because, again, they bring it every time they cross the lines on the games. So I think everybody would be shocked if they don't win it based on their performance. And yet every team that's playing right now that is still left, they're all really good. So, you know, if UCLA can slow them down, I didn't think UCLA would be able to slow down Michigan and hold them to 47 points, but they did. Heck of a job. So,
yeah, and that was with Alton on the side too. Okay, last thing. We've seen UCLA make the Final Four with Ben Howland, and yet for whatever reason, he could never keep everybody happy there. What does Mick have to do? I mean, other than you continue to win, is there anything you can do at UCLA to be more accepted? Because, you know, the Ben thing, I mean, I do think that there's some recruiting stuff that went awry and some of the ways in which he was perceived and guys he played and guys he didn't play, et cetera. They never really seem to get into Steve Alford, but that's like every UCLA coach, right? Where they don't, even Jim Herrick won a national title and yeah, he had the Monty's thing and the expense reports, but that seems so minor, but they were never truly into Jim Herrick. Like what can you and I have been around it our whole lives, but you've actually been in the league for over a decade. So how do you fix the UCLA thing where there's always a disconnect?
I think everybody looks at all these other things, but Kentucky, Duke, those are two examples this year where, I mean, they just flat out weren't the same program. And I think UCLA, both for Steve Alford and Ben Howland, you know, the biggest problem they had every year was turnover, you know, and you just mentioned it earlier. I mean, they had so many kids that were playing only 1 or 2 years in the program. I mean, you know, Steve Alford has the year with Lonzo Ball, that TJ Leaf, Lonzo Ball, and I forgot the other big kid's name. I mean, they have three freshmen go to the draft right away. I mean, there's your recruiting class done. And you're, every year you're constantly having to bat 1,000 with who you bring in. And if you don't, you're in trouble. And I think that's what's kind of happened a little bit with Kentucky and Duke this year. But that's what happened with UCLA. I think both Ben Howland and Steve Alford had some of those same issues. I think that's been a huge issue for them. But for Mick, with this particular team, I think you pointed it out earlier. I mean, they got some really good players, but do they have anybody who's a surefire 10-year pro on their team? I don't know. And obviously Johnny Juzang's been tremendous. But, you know, I don't know that they have anybody who's going to put their name in the draft when the season's over.
Probably Juzang does just because he's been so good. But Juzang's a guy who they got the benefit of. You know, he goes to Kentucky and he sees some adversity and he leaves, right? And so he's already seen how hard it is to make it in college basketball. You know, so even as a sophomore, he's kind of seen the other side to it. So there's a different level of buy into what he's doing in terms of his workouts and understanding for how valuable time and minutes are. And he had to kind of earn it, you know? So like even that kind of worked out in their favor, you know?
But they're going to return an experienced core lineup of kids even next year is the point.
Yes.
Whereas,
Joaquin's not going anywhere. Kyman's not going anywhere. Yeah. What's the other? Singleton's not going anywhere. You know, as long as they're happy with their playing time, which it'd be really amazing. You know, I saw Adam Miller, a freshman who started for Illinois, like in the portal, like, dude, you started as a freshman on a team that won the Big Ten tournament and kind of won the Big Ten. Like, what more do you want? I don't get it.
I think the you know, that's why coaches are constantly recruiting and, you know, always if you're not, you're in trouble, you know, and people are always be recruiting. I think is the, you know, and you, because you never know who's going to surprise you and leave, and you have to protect the program as a whole. You were asking specifically about UCLA, but I think all those teams, you're going to look and see a lot of these teams. You know, the interesting thing, everybody in the NCAA gets their year back. But it, at the Power Five level, very few kids that are seniors are going to stay and repeat that fifth year or take advantage of that, because they want to go play professionally. And then you only have such a small window to make money, whether you're going to make money as an NBA player or as overseas. So I understand, but it is an interesting thing in that regard as well.
I think there's a bit of a misconception there, to be honest with you, overseas. Like, I understand the NBA, they do have a tendency to pick you apart. But when you go overseas, like, they don't usually, it's not really about potential. You know, they're not going to stash you away for a couple years. There's no G League thing. They're not going to, can they loan you out to another team? Yeah, but there's very few teams that want to do that. So I almost feel like some of these guys, like, if you are not, you know, established as to who you are and what you're about and what type of player you are, then stay another year and continue to build up kind of your resume and your game, so that when you do get that opportunity overseas, like, you're ready. Like, you can just kick butt. But I understand that's not what people will do. I'm just saying that would be my, having lived it, like, it's so much better to be ready and, you know, to have a completely refined game and be mature, because you're playing against grown men. When you get over there, you'll play against a 28-year-old dude that's his paycheck, you know?
Kids are always going to view themselves as the exception to the rule, though. And right now, if we didn't have the pandemic, the G League was really showing themselves to be a viable force and a good alternative for kids, to where there was a lot of kids that were getting an opportunity through the G League to make it to the NBA. Now, making it to the NBA, playing in the NBA and actually getting an NBA contract are really two different things, right? But there's a lot of people that did get an opportunity. And I think a lot of those kids right now that we're talking about are thinking, look, I'll go play in the G League and I'll get an opportunity for, you know, a call up, or, you know, be on, you know, be one of those two-way players. Whether they are going to be or not, that's the way they view themselves usually. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. And again, I think the more important thing is just figuring out who wants to be there, who's got 2 feet in, and go to work. And then when the season's over, you know, I think if those are their aspirations, you know, you got to wish them well. And that's why you got to be thinking, you know, right now the trend is worry about who's on your roster for next year, you know, and don't worry about, you know, it's hard to worry about 3 years until you worry about next year. So if they just, that's what I think a lot of coaches are doing right now. And maybe some coaches won't say that, but you can look at what the trend is in terms of recruiting. What that's hurt is hurt opportunities for high school players, because there's one, high school players coaches didn't get out to see high school players this year. There are schools where kids can have another year, so that's less high school players are going to get recruited because of that. And then because they're taking transfers, instead of recruiting a high school player, they're shuffling the deck. And so people are getting, you know, recycled, let's say. And so I think there's a lot of parents right now of kids who are in the 2021 class that are concerned that there won't be a whole lot of opportunities for their kids.
Perfect spot to end it on. Appreciate you joining me.
You got it, Dougie.
All right. There's a little bit of precursor, getting ready for the Final Four. Plus, get a little flavor to what it's really like at the Final Four. Feel free to send me out some tweets and some questions. I think we'll record one after the game and have that up on Sunday. But continue to download. This thing is growing leaps and bounds. I know you guys love the stories. I love the stories as well. We'll get more of them for you. In the meantime, enjoy the games. My Twitter handle is @GottliebShow. The Doug Gottlieb Show runs 3 to 6 Eastern daily, or 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, the iHeartRadio app. Remember to tell a friend about this. Tweet it out. Tell people you like it, you don't like it, whatever. Write a review, hopefully a good one. Download, subscribe, rate, write a review. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.